This is John Erickson, Advanced Ball Striking. I've got Greg Laverne with me today. We're going to talk a little bit about Mo Norman. What were the core years, Greg, that you spent with Mo?
John, it would have to be during the early 70s and through the 80s. I met Mo in 1974, and I spent all the 70s with him and the early part of the 80s. Up to about 83, 84, I ended up going out to Hillcrest Sports Center. I took a head job out there. And it was a 1,000-member golf club, and Mo thought it'd be really good for me to go in that. And then after my time there, I had went on to university. And I met Mo later when he came out to visit me at the Belvedere Golf Club in Charlottetown. But to answer your question, it was during the 70s and early 80s was when I learned the golf swing from Mo Norman.
How is it watching Mo play in tournaments? You got a chance to see him play in tournaments a few times, right?
Yeah, I've seen him play, and also he played with me. He was my partner at Bay of Quinte Golf Club in a pro that we had, so quite a bit of experience playing with Mo.
What do you think really made Mo special?
His ball striking. He was the straightest hitter, I think, in the world, as far as I'm concerned, you know, bar none. It was his ability to be able to drive the ball down the middle of the fairway and position himself so that he could hit it in close. And he was a good iron player because he had great flight on his ball, and you know he would hit these beautiful irons that would go up in the air and come straight down and float right down, you know, on top of the flagstick. Eh? Mm-hmm. He was always target oriented. Eh? So, but his belief was to always have a target to hit the fairway. He'd be looking at a target when he hit the fairway. He'd be looking at a target which was always the pin. He'd always be shooting over top of the pin.
What was Mo like out on the golf course? Was he pretty, you know, concentrating? Was he chatty when he was playing? And what was he like to play with when you spent time with him?
Oh, he was always fooling around, laughing and that type of thing, right up till he hit it. You know, it's kind of funny. It's almost like a show, you know, like he's there kibitzing with everybody and talking, and then all of a sudden he just stands up and hits it and just, you know, shots out of this world, eh?
So kind of like Lee Trevino a little bit in that way.
Very much so, you know. I think it kept Mo loose too, you know, especially when he was in his comfort zone, when he felt good and that type of thing. He'd hit incredible shots.
How did Mo approach playing a golf course? I mean, did he spend a lot of time preparing? Was he out, you know, if he was going to play a tournament, was he out walking the golf course before, or would he just kind of show up and, you know, what was his sort of approach towards, you know, preparing for, you know, play?
Well, as you know, most of the golf courses in Canada, Mo played anyway. And, he had a very good memory, okay? So, you know, if he played a golf course, he'd know every hole and where he hit it and all this type of thing, you know? He never needed yardage books. He never needed any of that stuff, you know? It was just, he knew exactly what he could go out and shoot a real good score without a practice round. As you know, he had many course records in Toronto and all over Canada.
Yeah, I know he wasn't a yardage and pin sheet guy. I know you talked about how he was walking down the fairway and he was doing a lot of assessing of the shot before he got to the ball, and then he would enter from the side of the ball. He didn't really believe in getting back behind the ball and looking at the shot. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, to Mo, that was a waste of time, you know. He'd be walking up the fairway, and his pre-shot routine would start 20 or 30 yards before he approached the shot, and he'd know exactly what he was going to do and the type of shot he was going to hit. Then when he got up to the ball, he'd just walk in from the side and line it up, you know, at his target and fire, pull the trigger.
What do you think would Mo would think about today's game?
Well, it's a different game, obviously. You know, with the equipment that allows you to hit it so far, and that, and the way the courses are built, you know, long and more wide open allows players to hit the ball a long way off the tee and still get it on the green, where the courses that he played in his era were more tighter and you had to keep it on the fairway or you paid the price. And obviously with the persimmon, okay, that was used in our day, you know, you're not going to hit the ball as far. So you had to work the ball. You had to, you know, you had to hit golf shots, eh?
Yeah, the course was played plenty long enough back then. Hitting persimmon, a 6,800-yard course was pretty long. Now, what kind of ball was he playing in the Bellottas? I mean, was he hitting Titleists, or was he hitting Titleist Bellottas, or hitting the Max Fly, or what were some of the, do you remember what he was, what his ball choice was back then?
Always Titleist.
Yeah,
he believed Titleist was the best ball that was ever made, mm-hmm. And that's what he always played. Was always a Titleist. In fact, the majority of balls, even his practice balls, the big bag we used to hit and everything was all Titleist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about Mo's gear. You know, working from, let's say, his persimmons and, you know, down through his irons and wedges and stuff. So how did he set up his persimmons? I know they were really heavy from what I remember when I held them.
Well, they're all... his irons were E3s. I believe his woods were E5 or maybe just a little bit more, whatever felt good to him and that type of thing. But it was in that range. I still swing E3 and E5. What I did when I was 20 years old. I haven't, varied from that.
Yeah, that's good. I swing heavier gear now than I did when I was in my 20s. So.
Do you?
Yeah, I do.
Mo believed in mass, opposed to velocity. He wanted to feel the club head. He wanted something there, you know. The equipment today he would refer to as a licorice stick, you know. He wouldn't know how to hit it that way, you know. He had a set of golf craft irons that he really liked, I remember, and he had a few sets that he had in his car that he used from time to time, but that was the one that he usually used in tournaments and that type of thing. His persimmons, he varied. He had some Tungby Armors and some Iomatics. I remember an Iomatic driver, and then he also had a there was a company in Toronto at the time, Fletcher Golf. They made a big Blungeon block, and he kind of liked like that. I know this because when I was down south, he gave me some drivers to take back for him when I was going back to Canada, and then he'd get them at the other end from me when we met.
Now with his irons, did he have them over length at all, or what kind of shafts did he have in them? I know he had his irons settled bent a little bit upright, right, because he was swinging more off a shoulder plane.
Yeah, it was 3 degrees upright that he had it, and that was to accommodate his hand position.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, his left wrist was high and oval, okay, and he always lined it up with the leading edge, okay, which he filed. All his irons, the leading edge was filed. That made the clubs fit. Even squarer for him. As far as shaft goes, he used a double X shaft when I knew him through the area, through that area. I believe as he got a little bit older, I noticed that he went to X shafts, so mm-hmm. Just softened that a little bit, that's all. He liked it right there. He wanted it right there, you know, through impact.
What about his wedges? Anything you remember about how he had his wedges set up? I mean, I know he had the Sandy Andy with the sand wedge, a kind of unusual sand wedge.
Well, the Sandy Andy, as I've explained before, it was used in the bunkers only, mm-hmm. And he used it sometimes around the green, if it was heavy rough or that type of thing, you know, just to get the ball out. But normally he would just use a pitching wedge for most shots. As far as his wedges goes, he always had lead tape on the back, you know, weighted up. And that was, you know, that was really to bring it up to E3. And, you know, because you could only put a certain amount of shot in the shafts, eh?
Right.
At the time, so.
Yeah, I remember he didn't have any offset on his irons at all. That's something I remembered.
Now, he did give me a set of top flights that were offset a little bit, but I believe most of the irons that Mo used were straight.
Pretty straight, and maybe that's why he gave them to you.
Probably, but you know, Mo's got a good heart. He always, you know, he always did. Like he gave me that, and then he gave me the wedge that I still have. You know, it was similar to the Sandy Andy, only a little smaller version, eh?
What were some of Mo's thoughts on putting? You know, we talk a lot about his ball striking, but, I mean, you can't win all those tournaments without being a pretty good putter also.
As I've said before, I think people have a misconception there. Mo was a good putter, okay? It's just that he may not have been recognized as a good putter for as close as he hit it all the time, where a good putter would have shot maybe even lower scores, you know? But he shot a lot of 63, 64, 65s. You have to putt well to shoot those scores.
Yeah, you sure do. Did he use a light putter or heavy putter? What was, do you remember?
I remember in the days that I was with him, okay, he liked this ping putter. It was like a brass ping putter.
Uh-huh.
And he liked that. He used to use that quite a bit. Mo looked at putting a little different. It was more of a feel thing to him. Like he softened up a little bit, you know, and it was trying to, you know, feel comfortable and basically trying to, you know, use his shoulders and that and work them under, you know, the same in a pendulum motion, eh?
Mm-hmm.
It's just he got a little bit more with, he always, if you notice when Mo putted, he always let his right hand sort of work the ball, eh? A little bit.
Yeah, he putted really quick. I know he didn't spend much time. I mean, sometimes it seems like he didn't even line the putt up. He'd just get over it and sort of sight it from above and then just send it on its way. I mean,
yeah, he didn't really take the time that he should have, maybe on the green. I would have liked to see him slow down a little bit on the green, you know.
Do you think maybe he was just assessing everything as he was walking up to the green and he just felt like he kind of had it all in his head when he got over the putt?
Oh yeah, similar to a shot in the fairway. You mm-hmm. know, he knew exactly what he was going to do, so he just did it. He just hit it. But I think with the putting, you know, if he would have slowed down a little bit more, I think he you know, he might have, you know, maybe putted a little better than what he did. But at the same time, you know, he made a lot of putts too.
You sure, know, sure.
Without second thoughts getting in his head. And maybe that was one of the reasons why he was so quick, is he made up his mind and he just wanted to, you know, execute it without allowing other thoughts to get in his head.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea. Now, getting to his golf swing, you know, I mean, the first thing people notice about Mo is his setup, you know, that kind of unorthodox setup that, you know, most people would see it as unorthodox, but I certainly understand the logic of it. Hands high, and he'd set the club a foot or two behind the ball. What did he tell you about that as far as his reasoning for setting up that way?
Well, it's a great foundation what he created, you know, with the wide stance, you know, so solid, and it allows the legs to work properly in the swing, okay, down the line when you're wider. Also, the high hands, that was a high position that he created, because that was the position that he wanted to return through impact.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with the top of the, from the top of the left shoulder to the tip of the club, one straight line.
Yeah, yeah.
As far as putting the club way behind the ball, there's a lot of advantages to that. You know, you can't take the club outside. The club works back into the inside for you, so you get much more rotation, and you're already getting the club back with great width. I saw a lot of the players that put the ball up to the club. You know, they have a lot of trouble starting it. You know, because their first move, they start taking the club outside.
Yeah, I agree. I think that first initial move away from the ball is the most difficult. A lot of people forward press, kick the knee, do all sorts of things. You know, but just getting it, getting the club working back and around behind you. I think Mo was unique in that he with the set up with the hands high, but he took a real shallow flat backswing with a lot of forearm rotation, and I think that's, you know, something that was really original and unique about Mo's action.
Oh yeah, and this is why I disagreed so much with Natural Golf, where they were trying to when they first came up, when they were saying that no rotation and all this. Like, Mo rotated his shoulders and hips and everything, mm-hmm. You know, as you witnessed with the pictures from the 60s of Mo, right?
Sure.
You know. And right on, a lot of rotation going back, just like Hogan. There's a reason for that. You have to get the club back into a position inside, so that you're in a proper position to make your transition or a vertical drop from the inside.
Yeah, the vertical drop, that's something I know you talked a lot about in the book, and certainly something Mo demonstrated to me when I spoke with him. I know he talked a lot about kind of the right palm up and working the club down from behind, and I think was a really key move for not only Mo but all the great ball strikers that I've seen.
Well, yes, in that first book I authored, I basically explained that of the it was one of the things that Mo told me was the left palm went to the right heel on his transition, which is really a Berkeley term as far as the vertical drop goes. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But besides that, that's really what starts everything, okay? Where the legs move automatically. You don't even have to think. So think of the legs or the weight shift or everything when the vertical drop is made properly.
Yeah, Mo always told me he hit the ball with his chest and his legs.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot to do with once it got into the pre-impact position. Okay, there was a lot of rotation through it with the legs and that the left knee automatically when the vertical drop is made moves right at the target, you know,
mm-hmm.
And then the right side moves down and through with the rotation of the shoulders.
It certainly appeared to me he put a lot of pressure down into the right foot at transition, and that right foot was really, really down for about as long as I've seen anybody keep it down.
Well, he explained to me a long time ago what goes up, what must come down, and that was a term that we used to use because, as you know, his left shoulder always went to the sky, okay, you know, and generated, and so naturally the right side has to come down, okay, the right foot,
mm-hmm.
And there's a bow in the right side. Hogan had that bow on his right side, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, on ABS, we'd call that spine tilt, I think, and as it kind of opens up a passageway for the arms to get down into the slot. So you don't, you know, a lot of the stack and tilt and these guys that are trying to swing with a torso real erect at transition, I don't think that works so well.
But a lot of people don't understand that the right elbow and everything, what everybody tries to drive in and do this and do that, they're doing it all artificially, because if it's dominated with the left side and throughout the golf swing, the right elbow automatically goes in and rubs along the chest.
Now Mo really had a firm and solid left knee going through impact, a lot like Byron Nelson. Did he talk to you? I know he had you doing some drills in your book about that.
That's just what happens when the vertical drop is made properly. You know, the left knee moves. You're put into more of a sitting position through the ball.
Mm-hmm.
I know Snee did it. Byron Nelson maintained his left knee, you know, flex even after impact, you know.
Yeah.
We do the same thing. There's no spinning of the left side or anything like that. It's because we're working down the line, and then everything is released naturally.
Mm-hmm.
The stomach automatically goes right to the target without effort.
Yeah, I remember, you know, Mo was very, very firm and bent in the left knee going through the shot, and his torso turned really level, and his arms then kind of released out and then up, and it was a very, very natural-looking action.
Oh, yes. As I've mentioned, okay, you can only get into that position and be able to do it like what you've described there of the left knee going down the line, and then the shoulders rotating on plane, you know, through the shot. If you get low through the ball, now Mo dropped it on an entirely different plane. There's no such thing as a one plane swing, okay, when it comes to Mo Norman. All right, mm-hmm. I don't care what anybody says, because Mo dropped it on an entirely different plane on the transition, and his reason for that was to be as low as he could through the ball, keeping the club face as square as possible, as long as he could.
Now Mo's finish, you know, Mo would kind of, he'd finish the club, he'd like to finish it straight up and pointing at the sky. Did he talk about that with you, and what his reasoning was for that?
Of course, as you know, when Mo hit the golf ball, it would be like a normal golf swing going through. The extension that you see after the fact, okay, to the target, okay, was more of a recess, all right, that he pointed the club to the target, okay, and that was because his mind was so focused on being target oriented. But the main thing, okay, is when he went through the ball, he would continue after impact with what we refer as the horizontal tuck. The left would keep extending through to give him a great extension, and the back of the left hand would ride right up to the top of his finish, where other players have released far too early at impact, and naturally their hands go to the left and release.
Yeah,
where our release was further out in front of us.
He used to tell me, he said, I'm a waiter, don't spill the tray.
Yeah, you're right on that. Where the weight, the tray is, okay, it's actually in two positions. It's on the backswing, okay? Uh-huh. It's as he was holding a tray on the backswing, and it's also at pre-impact, okay, where the right palm is facing the sky,
uh-huh.
Just as if he was holding a tray.
Yeah.
I demonstrated it in the book as the karate chop, okay? But it's basically the same thing. You can say holding a tray or the karate chop, eh?
Yeah, Mo is very left side dominant swinging the club. I know Paul Henrich mentioned how his left pectoral muscle was twice the size of his right one.
Absolutely. That's actually, I guess you could refer it in Berthley's critique of Mo, the deltoid muscle, okay, uh-huh. was very developed, as you say there. The reason for that is because it's all left side dominance, okay? Right when the vertical drop takes place, the left is generating, and that muscle is really working.
He always said, hit through the ball. That was one of his things that he was always making a point of, accelerating through the ball.
Oh, yes. The idea of hitting through the ball is that you never hit to the ball, because that's when the right side takes over too early. The right arm cast, the right shoulder roll, all that stuff. Always hit through the ball. Keep that club face going as long as you can past impact. There's a reason for that. That the club stays on its target line as long as possible. There's no twisting and turning, and you see you're staying level all the way down the line. Eh?
Now I know you studied martial arts and you were a black belt in karate. Is that correct?
Yes, I actually did a black belt here in Dartmouth. It took me 5 years, and there's a lot of things that I took from my training in the martial arts that I put into the golf. particularly the exercises. The exercises that we do is phenomenal for flexibility. I do them every day, and they just work very well with the golf swing. Never a sore muscle. I never had any sore muscles hitting the golf ball anyway, the way Mo taught me and stuff. But this keeps you even more flexible so that you can get more rotation and, through the ball, and I should say going back, and you're moving so freer. As far as other things in the martial arts, the breathing was very important too, particularly breathing through your nose and out your mouth, and from the chi, which is really where all your energy is, and that. And if you can do this in the when you're on the golf course, it really will help you.
Yeah, sure. Now, what was Mo's relationship with George Knudsen? I know they were, had a lot of respect for one another.
Oh, great amount of respect. They were both very talented ball strikers. I don't think that there was any ones better than those two in Canada. George was very very popular in the States for his ball striking too when he played the tour. As far as Mo and George, they were competitors against each other, but they always had respect for each other and each other's talent. Naturally, as competitors, they both wanted to beat each other's ass every time they went out and played. And they wanted, they would get together and have little competitions now and again when they were, I think one of them was when they went out and I think Mo hit six flag sticks, and they were playing, they had some money game there for, how many flags they hit, or how much a flag, or if they knocked it on the green or whatever. And I think Mo came out on top on that. But I mean, it's the relationship was very, very good that way, as far as respect for each other and what they were trying to achieve.
Yeah, hitting six pins in a round is pretty amazing. I asked Mo one time what his best ball striking round was, and that's exactly what he said. He said six pins, six. Yeah. And, I actually hit three pins in a round myself one time, and which was, seemed almost like kind of a fluke or something. But I can see where, it would be possible. I mean, if I could hit three, I'm sure Mo could hit six. I mean, that's pretty incredible stuff to hear about that, but... I don't think something like that is just mythology. I mean, I do believe it. Now, when Mo went down and played the PGA Tour a little bit, right? It was one year, half a year, and something like... I know a lot of people wonder why he didn't play down the States on the tour, and I know you mentioned that he felt a little bit uncomfortable, but did he ever talk to you about that or his experience down there, down south?
Well, I didn't really get into a lot of it with Mo on that. We talked about it, he played the tour, okay, and really what I got out of it was more, they didn't accept him, because the way he dressed then and during that era, it wasn't like now that he had, how he has all nice clothes and everything expensive, the best you could buy, right, uh-huh. In golf, where, it was totally a different attire that he wore. Because that's all he could afford. Nobody would give him anything then, to get him situated. These guys, don't forget that he was competing against, had everything handed to them, okay? Basically with, the best of this, best of that. And, he was going down there with old clothes and did the best. But his talent, shined over everybody. And they all knew this. He played a year anyway. The last I heard was that he finished third in New Orleans. And then after that, he basically left the tour.
Now, the Canadian Tour, before I played up there, was called the Peter Jackson Tour, right? That was back in the 70s. And I know the money wasn't really all that great. And you had certainly a lot of talented players up there playing for not a lot of money.
Oh, yeah. Like, you had guys like Bob Panasek, George Knudsen even came up to play, when he wasn't playing When he came back home and that, he would compete and that, but they were playing for like $3,500 for first, you know, during that era, you know. Even on the Canadian tour, quite a big jump, you know, to now if they win 20,000, right?
Now, from kind of the end of the 70s coming into the 80s, then, you know, I met Mo in 87. But somewhere in there, maybe between 80 and 87, there were kind of some dark years for Mo. I mean, as far as, you know, not a lot of money and, you know, living in his car and all that. And I know some of the guys used to go around with a hat when he'd be hitting balls and just try and get some of the guys to pony up a few bucks for him to, you know, help him pay for a few things. And, you know, what, you weren't really around him much during that time, right?
No. As I said, like, after I went to, my time was during the 70s and early 80s with him, where I, you know, I really was into the, you know, the golf swing, and we were one-on-one practicing and playing and that type of thing. It was after, during that time that he was in the Toronto area, and I was out east, okay, because I was going to school and stuff. So he did have those times, but then when he got involved there with Natural Golf, he started doing clinics and stuff like that, and that's when he came out afterwards.
Yeah, that was much later, though. But I guess you could, it's not a stretch to say Mo's personality was a bit quirky and maybe not something that was going to work being a club pro, for instance, you know, working in a pro shop, and that wasn't really his calling, I don't think.
Well, I know about that, too. Mo used to teach golf, okay, at the De Havilland golf range for a fellow named Bert Turcotte when he owned it. And, you know, he'd give lessons and that type of thing. And but it, as you say, it wasn't really his calling, you know. He would do it, and it was just basically to make some money, right?
Mm-hmm.
But his love was to hit the golf ball and play the tour, right? So that's what he concentrated on. He was the playing pro at Golf Haven in just north of Toronto. That's where we used to go. We used to meet at Pleasure Park, and then we'd drive up in his Cadillac up to Golf Haven, and that's where we would practice, play nine holes and hit four balls a hole.
Yeah, I know Mo, he didn't believe in banks, right? He was buried his money, and that's maybe not such a bad idea, huh?
Well, he didn't trust them, you know, as far as that goes. He liked to have his money, let's say, accessible to him, okay? So, because he did a lot of travel, you know, he was all over the place, right? You know, traveling the Canadian tour, and then when he, you know, he would go south, and, you know, as soon as October came, he would leave to head for Tomoka Oaks. And he always liked to have, you know, his money, so it was, you know, he could just go get it and go, you know, he was that way.
You know, if you had to pick two or three things that Mo really hammered home or instilled in you, you know, as being a student of Mo, what would you say they were?
Well, I think the most important thing is to have integrity, okay? Mo had a lot of, he was very high on integrity and that type of thing. The other things would be to believe in yourself, always to believe in yourself and believe in, you know, what you're doing or trying to achieve. He always used to say that most people live on hope and fear, okay? And he says you can't do that. He says you have to believe. And then one of the other things that was very important was just work hard. And Mo did that. He worked hard. See, there's so many people that want to get information on the golf swing, and they think it's just going to be magic and happen to them, you know, overnight, right? Because they know this. It don't work that way. Even as good as Mo was, he practiced every day and worked so it would, he would develop a repetitive golf swing, you know, so he could repeat every time. And that takes work. Mo wasn't the only one. Hogan did it. Knutson did it.
Yeah.
Trevino did it.
Yeah, great.
All the great ball strikers.
So Mo would, it wasn't uncommon for Mo to hit 500 balls a day, even up to 800 balls a day, right?
Oh, no. Like, that was, you know, that was normal. what our routine was, is like if we were just going to hit balls, we'd hit up to, you know, we'd hit 800 balls a day, you know. If we were going to go out and play, we'd probably hit half of those, probably 300 or 400, and then go play nine holes and hit four balls a hole. And that would be a day for, you know, practice day. Now, he wouldn't hit a lot of balls before a tournament. He just, you know, he'd hit, you know, maybe 200 or 300 or something like that, and then, you know, just to stay loose and keep his focus on what he was trying to do.
How many balls would he hit in the morning before he tee off?
Do you mean like when he was playing a tournament?
Yeah, playing a tournament, he shows up at the golf course, and would he hit a bucket of balls? Would he just hit a few? Would he hit a few hundred? What was, do you remember?
Well, Mo would usually practice before he went to the tournament, okay? Uh-huh. In other words, he would go and practice, like if he had a late tee off time, he'd go and practice early in the morning and then go, you know, to the tournament. If he just went to the tournament, he might just hit a few balls to loosen up and that. He'd spend more time on the putting green and that, and then talking to everybody, you know, and that, and then just go tee off. As Mo said, the hardest thing to do is to take it from the practice tee to the verse tee. Mo never had any problem with that, but I mean, he always just used it more so just to loosen up.
Well, you do a great job of swinging like Mo, better than anybody I've seen, and I think a lot of it has to do with your post-impact pivot acceleration, something that I teach a lot. And when I see some of the other people trying to teach Mo's action, that seems to be the thing that they're missing. A lot of them can, you know, everyone can set up like Mo and get it back like Mo, but nobody goes through it like Mo does in the way you do. So do you think anyone can learn to swing like Mo, or do you think it takes something special to be able to do that?
It takes the knowledge and obviously to be able to show them too, you know.
Sure.
I think that I've made great progress. I had a student that I've taught out in Calgary. He actually flew me out and I taught him for a week, and he's making great progress. Like 2 years later, now I've taught him, you know, for that week, and we've corresponded over the phone. His name's Tim Lynch. He's a left-hander, and I taught him, and he's still hitting it like arrow. In fact, he went out the other day, and it's cold here in Canada, as you know, and didn't even practice or anything, and went out and hit the ball great, you know, without practicing every day. Because once you get it, and once you know what you're trying to do and achieve, then it becomes a lot simpler, you know.
Yeah, sure. So if somebody wants to learn Mo's swing, I mean, certainly you're the guy to go and see. How do people get a hold of you?
I have my email, greglaverne_5@hotmail.com. They can get in touch with me, and okay. That's probably the best way. Yeah. And then from there we can make correspondence, you know. But yes, I'd have to agree with you as far as if they want to learn to move like Mo and the real way he did it, you know, I would be the guy to see. Lawson Mitchell's also very good and has the knowledge of what Mo did. Lawson couldn't do what I do, you know, or move that way. He was more of a conventional swinger, okay? You know, and but it's just, I guess I just had the opportunity to spend a lot of time with Mo, and with all the balls that we hit together, it just developed muscle memory, and that's why I move so similar to him.
Well, I've seen a lot of imposters out there, and what I look for is what's going on after impact, and that's what I was impressed with your swing, is that you were really driving the club through the way Mo always talked about.
Thank you. Yeah, Mo really taught me to keep hitting, you know, way beyond the ball. And as he always told me, he said, me and you release in a different way than everybody else. Okay. And, I think that, the way he started me, okay. It was a basic thing of getting that butt going down the fairway. Okay. You know?
So what do you have to say to some of these Mo imposters out there?
Well, I think a lot has to do with the era that they met Mo. It was later on when he was an older man, and he never performed the swing the way that they're emphasizing to the general public. You know, I knew him like through the 70s and 80s when he was hitting the ball, probably close to the best in the world. And, you know, he took the full swing, an entirely different swing than what they're trying to promote. Plus, what they do say, both Graves and Natural Golf and any of these other promoters, is just the basic stuff that everybody knows. The real nitty-gritty, they don't have a clue about. But yet they go on and try to make out like they're the authority on Mo and all this. No, I have to say, if there's any authority on Mo, it would be Lawson and myself. Probably more so myself, because I had the opportunity to practice and play with him every day, you know, yeah. and really learn it. I think a fellow like yourself, Lag, that played the tour in Canada and played with Mo, really understands, you know, the difference.
Well, I certainly learned a lot from Mo. I didn't spend as much time with him as you did, obviously, but I did spend as much time with him as I could, and yep. You know, I realized what I was seeing was something special, and I'm not sure all the guys really quite embraced that the way they should have at the time. But you know, sometimes it's, you know, you don't realize what's standing right in front of you.
What I sort of got out of it, okay, is these people had good intentions, I guess, okay, like a promoting Mo and all this type of thing, but it was mostly observations of taking videos of Mo, and then they made their own observations, just like this single plane golf swing that's out. That's something that Todd Graves dreamed up, okay? I never heard once that Mo mentioned a single plane golf swing in all the time I knew him and that. And there's a lot more, you know, to Mo's swing than what they're making out, you know?
Well, your book was excellent. I thank you for writing that and spending the time to do that with you and Lawson. Now, you've got another book coming out. You want to tell us a little bit about how this book's going to differ than the last one, or is it just kind of a continuation of what you were talking about in the first book?
Well, on the first book, as you know, Lawson and myself authored it. Second book, it's more advanced stuff that was in the first book. I plan on doing this second book. It'll be a brand new product with Lawson, and we're gonna really get into the nitty gritty about the advanced stuff. You know, like really what Mo did in the swing. You know, beyond. I did give one of the secrets that Mo told me, beyond the general stuff and everything that we worked on in the swing that, you know, most people are familiar with. And that was where the left palm went to the right heel, okay? And I did put that in the first book. But I've held on to something that that I haven't even told anybody. And it's going to come out in the second book. And it's really Mo's final secret. And there is a secret, let me tell you. And it will show how Mo got his real purity and his flight on his ball and everything. We're seeking a good publisher now, and I'm in the process of writing it up.
Well, that's exciting. We'll all look forward to checking that out. Let us know when you get that finished up, and we'll certainly do what we can to help you move some books. Also, any final thoughts? Anything you want to talk about before we sign off here?
It would be good to have a final book that everybody can relate to, that this is what Mo did. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Not all this other stuff that's been out there. And what I'm delivering, okay, is really right from the horse's mouth. What he taught me, what I actually do in my swing, you know? And I think there's a big difference.
Yeah, I agree. I always think it's important that an instructor can properly demonstrate principles, whatever they are. And I know there's a lot of people trying to teach Mo and Hogan and all this. You know, I don't think anyone has ever hit it quite as good as Mo or as good as Hogan or any of these guys. So they're obviously they know something that the rest of us don't know. But I think we can maybe get a little closer to it than the average general person might be speculating.
Yeah, there's a lot of speculation, and it certainly doesn't help if they're giving information that's just based on their own opinions and that type of thing, okay? Mm-hmm. Like, if they take a video and then make their own analysis of Mo, you know, that's no good because they're only just believing what these guys say, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you actually have somebody that learned from Mo, that hit balls with them, that practice with them, you know, and not only, you know, my golf relationship with them, I was also a really close friend to him, and he told me and Lawson everything that he wanted us to know, you know. It was a big difference.
Thanks a lot, Greg. Appreciate it, and we'll be checking back with you soon.